You have reached a phone call from Paul. Prepare to be entertained and moved. A chat with Elizabeth Gilbert. Part 2.
So in Miami now, you mentioned two things. You're thinking of your next book, which might be a novel. But you're also reading. Maybe let's start with reading. What are some of the things you're reading now that when you're not, you know, speaking and on this book tour for Big Magic, what is filling your soul?
Well, there's stuff I'm reading because I want to help friends. So I have some manuscripts that I'm reading for people right now. And that's something that I like, you know, when I have time, I like to be able to do. But it's not so much filling my soul.
Yeah.
In some way it is, because it's me feeling like I'm a member of a community and I'm helping people and I'm giving them blurbs and I'm, you know, maybe finding an agent for their book or that sort of thing. But what I've been reading lately that I think is great, well, Adam Phillips, actually. You really put me on an Adam Phillips kick. So Unkindness is something that I've been reading, and Unbalance at the same time. Those are both
a magnificent book where he talks maybe that the point is not balance necessarily. It's
yes.
So interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and I've been very much against the word balance in the way that it's being used lately. Every time you open up a women's magazine and some celebrity is being interviewed and we're being told about how she found balance between motherhood and health and career, and I was like, oh, can we just embrace the glorious mess that we are rather than trying to
put
this thing
that
was never...
And the fact that so many of the things...
To be in balance.
Right, and so many of the great moments in our lives are precisely about, you know, falling.
Falling.
And then, you know,
yes.
We fall in love. I mean, there's so many
yes.
things about this fall, and it begins, you know,
yeah.
in biblical times, obviously, with a grand fall. The whole
yes.
story begins. So this notion of, you know, finding equilibrium in that
yes.
way might be misguided. But,
and I like the word equilibrium better, right? Equal
yeah.
freedom. Freedom to fall in any direction.
That's right. So what besides Adam Phillips,
yeah.
what?
I'm also reading David Mitchell for the first time. I had never read him before, and I read The Bone Clocks. I thought it was fantastic. Have you ever interviewed him?
No.
So great.
How I now I have at least two recommendations. The first one was David Hall? No.
Donald Hall.
Donald Hall.
The book is called Life Work.
Is there a particular that is a particular book that you think I should read?
Definitely. It goes down easy. It's a very slight but very rich memoir about, I think the first line is, I've never worked a day in my life. And it's talking about the kind of work that he's done, because he's always been an academic and a poet. And then he goes back in the history of his whole family from New Hampshire and all of what they did, which he considers actually working, you know, having farms and businesses. And then he's lived the life of the mind, really. But it's very, very beautiful.
And is there a particular poet you love? A poet of his you love?
I'm trying to think if I can come up with one offhand. Maybe not. No. His poems about his former wife, Jane Kenyon, he shares something in common with Jack Gilbert, which is that they both lost the love of their life. They both married a much younger woman, and both of them had that woman die, as Jack Gilbert did as well, which my husband, who's older than me, calls breaking the rules. He's like,
fantastic.
Whenever we talk about Donald Hall or Jack Gilbert, he said, those women broke the rules, right? Like, don't you dare die before I do with this huge age difference before us. That's breaking the rules. You're not supposed
yeah.
to do that. Yeah, you know, it's not permitted. So he has written, as Jack Gilbert wrote a cycle of poems about his wife, Michiko. Donald Hall has written
yes.
extensively about Jane Kenyon.
I can't let that
yeah,
moment go, of course,
yeah.
of talking of our shared passion, for Jack Gilbert. I mean, I know you and I have spoken about one poem that we both love called Failing and Flying. But you begin Big Magic. I was so surprised and so delighted, obviously, that you begin Big Magic, your newest book, with Jack Gilbert. So for those people who are listening to us now who don't know Jack Gilbert, tell them something about him, because I must say, for me, he was a tremendous discovery, and I just love his poems, and I also love, I might say, the Paris Review interview with him, which is so fantastic.
Brilliant interview. Well, there was nowhere else I could start with Big Magic than with Jack Gilbert, because he is my poet laureate. I think we all have a poet laureate of our lives, somebody who's... And it doesn't have to be a poet. For some people, it's a novelist or a filmmaker. But for me, Jack Gilbert is the essence. He was an American poet, not very widely known while he was alive, because he didn't care. He had never promoted himself in any way whatsoever, but always very highly respected. Nominated for the Pulitzer with his first book in the 1950s, won the Yale Younger Poets Prize. He was a poet's poet. But he lived this remarkably uncompromising life where he was born in Pittsburgh in the 1920s and went out to California to become a poet as a young man, and then had great success with his first book, got very famous. He was very handsome, very charismatic. He certainly could have been a figure in the literary world and a rock star. And instead, he decided he wasn't interested in fame. As he said in the Paris Review interview, he said, because he said, it's not that it's corrupting or corroding, it's just that it's boring. It's the same thing every day. You go places and people get excited to see you. It's sort of dull. And he decided he wanted a life that was different every day. So he vanished and went off and lived in Europe for 20 years and mostly lived in Greece on a mountaintop and wrote poems but didn't share them for almost 20 years. And then produced another book and once more blew people's minds and then disappeared again, this time to Japan. Released another book after 12 years. I always say he was like a rare orchid that only blooms once every decade or so. And when he bloomed, it was always a spectacular event. And his work, to me, reads like women. It reads like the Psalms. It has magnitude and grandeur in it. It's like not afraid of magnitude. And my favorite poem of his is one called Refusing Heaven, where he gives the most articulate defense I've ever heard for why you must fight for joy even in a world of sorrows. And the line I love so much is when he says, we must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness and the ruthless fairness of this world. To me, that's as good as anything from the Psalms in terms of human comfort and how to live.
Once again, a quotation comes to my mind, which is something I've always loved of Camus, where he says, one has to love life before loving its meaning. For when the love of life has left us, no meaning can any longer console us.
Oh, that's so wonderful. So to love life without needing to understand it, right?
It's this, and I think many things you have said over the years are this kind of uncompromised call for joy, even in moments of tremendous sorrow. You know, I think of it presently quite a lot. I think of the great lines in Beckett, in The Unnameable, where he says, I can't go on, I will go on. And in some way, I think it's a call to rectitude. It's a call to service. We're here to be alive while we are. You know,
we're amazed, and here, present. There's Gloria Naylor, the novelist, who said life is not meant to make you feel good or feel bad. It's just meant to make you feel, right? That the fact that we feel things is incredible, and that we have, unlike it appears any other species on Earth, we have awareness of our awareness, is amazing. And it's a very strange thing, and it's a very beautiful thing, and it's a it's a very exciting thing. It doesn't mean it's pleasant.
Yeah. And who said it? And who said it would be? I mean, you know, life...
No one offered that. Yeah. Nobody ever offered
no,
that.
No, I mean, we're back to things we spoke about earlier. Nobody said it would be easy. And refusing heaven is one of my favorite. And now we're in a very fortunate position. I think it's Knopf that brought out the collected poems. And it's so...
Beautiful.
It's so beautiful. It's such a gift everybody should give themselves. Even those people who like myself, actually, I remember interviewing W.S. Merwin, and I admitted to him that I had interviewed so few poets, and he said, "Oh, I know, we're really a difficult bunch, aren't we?" And I said, "I don't read enough poetry." And he said, "You've got it wrong. You've got it wrong, Paul. Don't read poetry. Read poems."
Isn't
that great? I mean, so don't construct it into poetry. I actually think there's so much meaning to that, because I think as we age, we may read less poetry, we may read less fiction and read more nonfiction. But in a way, we should go back to those older passions when we were younger, and maybe break it down to a poem a day or something that will inspire us. That's why I was asking, you know, what feeds your soul, and you were trying to say something about David Mitchell, and I think I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. You know what? It's so funny when you were saying that W.S. Merwin thing. I thought you were going to say that he said, "Don't read poetry, write poetry," which is something I would add that you should also do.
Yes.
Because it doesn't have to be very good, whatever that even means, right? There's something that happens, and I've been doing that a lot lately. There's a way that I can, and I don't share them weirdly. I mean, maybe not weirdly, maybe wisely. It's a really good thing for me to do for myself. I can sit down in 10 minutes and I can write, and I'm almost using air quotes when I say this, but I don't know why. I can write a poem. It's a poem. You know, I didn't say it was a great one, but it's a poem, and I can write a poem about somebody and my feelings about that person or something that I'm going through that can get to the heart of the thing faster than, more efficiently and more profoundly than writing a 300-page nonfiction book about it. There's something that happens. I would recommend it, especially, I know you've had hard losses in your life lately, Paul, but like, write a poem. You'd be amazed. It's not just, reading.
I may very well try. I must say, I do get consolation, as I say, hopefully not cheap consolation, but I mentioned the Beckett line there. Mm-hmm. There are moments like that when I think about, or maybe Seneca on the brevity of life. I think about literature that has inspired me in moments of loss and mourning. And recently I was given a book of 49 poems on mourning that New Directions published, because I think in a certain Buddhist tradition, 49 days is about the time you take to mourn. Not that you don't continue to, but I remember when Laurie Anderson did that incredible tribute at the Apollo for Lou Reed. She did it on the 50th day. I think significantly.
Wow.
I think it's, you know, very powerful. So this book that is a wonderful book published by New Directions, as I mentioned, of poems of mourning. They I was about to say they help. They don't really help, but they may.
They console.
Yeah, they do console in some way. The same way as you know, music can sometimes do that.
Right.
But you know, Liz, I don't want to take up all the time you have away from this probably incredibly, maybe inspiring in some way, but also grueling book tour that you have for Big Magic. And I want you to go back to the beach, and I want you to drink wine with José. I want you to have time to read more of David Mitchell and the manuscripts. But I want to ask you one final question, which is the way in which you're living your life now. I was inspired and tempted to do the same and wonder how you went about getting rid of so many books.
Oh, gosh, yes, because you came and saw me after I got rid of my big house.
Yeah.
The first step to getting rid of your books is to acquire them all.
But trust me.
I'm sure you're on that. Trust me.
I've done that. I remember.
Right. Okay. So you did that step, and I did too. I had thousands of them, and then I bought a huge house and I made a huge library. You saw it. It was very beautiful. And I lived out the dream of that. And then I realized I'm not meant to stay in one place forever. I move around more than almost anybody I know, although I know you move around a lot too. And I'm done carrying these things. And carrying them is not worth it for me anymore for so many reasons, so many levels of reason. So here's how I did it. I went through my bookshelves and I touched each book. I pulled it out and held it in my hand, and I said, am I ignited by this? And so I think what happens is when we look at a big library, we feel a general warm glow at the thought of all those books there, right? It makes you feel sort of warm and happy. But which are the ones that are actually creating the energy that's making the heat in that room? It's not all of them. It's not even most of them. In your own life, it's actually only really a few of them. And so what I went through was, and the ignition that I felt when I would touch that book was almost mystical. And it was also, it didn't have to be because I loved that book. It could be because I loved that particular volume that had a huge sentimental reason for being in my life, right? That object. But mostly it was the book, like the words of the book itself. Does this ignite me to see this or not? And if the answer was yes, I kept it. I put it in a box. And if the answer was no, I walked away. And sometimes within an author, like I used to be a completist, like I have all of Martin Amis's books. But now I don't. Now I have three.
I was struck by that. You didn't.
There's only three.
You didn't want to do what would be culturally minded correct in some way, which is, you know,
right.
keep
there's
the complete
three.
Works of.
Yes, there's and only you, three that
and
really
said,
changed
and you
my,
said
blow
me,
my
I
mind.
Remember, you said, you know, maybe the complete works of Dickens, perhaps.
Those I have.
Perhaps.
Because they were my great-grandfathers, so they have a double ignition, right?
Yeah.
I have his actual physical object books, and it's Dickens. But aside from that, I'm not a completist on anybody. And then I called my local used bookstore and said, come and get the rest of them. Some of which were very valuable. I said, this is my donation to you and to the community. If you're willing to carry these in boxes down three flights of stairs, you can have them all.
I'm always reminded of in Latin, one form of calling possessions is to call them impedimenta. So, you know, they become impediments. If the backpack you're carrying is so heavy, you really don't see the landscape.
Yes. And I see, you know what's weird too is I've had a lot of elderly people die in my life lately, and I've had to break down houses. And now when they go into really rich, magnificent houses filled with stuff, I look at them and I think, man, someday you're going to die and someone's going to have to clean the shelf.
Gosh.
And I'm like, oh, don't do that to someone here. Get rid of some of it now, right? But the books, now I have one little wall of IKEA shelves in a very small bedroom. You saw it.
Yeah.
Every one of those books. There's an ignition spark in that room because every one of those books is a firework in my life. And there aren't many of them.
Magnificent. Well, it brings us back to Gilbert in a extraordinary way. I mean, Jack, of course, also Elizabeth. But the Jack it brings us back to is, you called him your poet laureate. They're just a few. You mentioned Donald Hall, and there are a few. In the end, we don't need hundreds of friends.
You just need one. You just need one really good one. You don't need hundreds of anything. You know, one fantastic pair of Italian-made shoes is better than a closet full of them from Target, right?
Yeah.
You don't need all this stuff. And the stuff that makes you feel ignited and excited, rather than burdened, is the stuff to keep, right? Life's heavy enough already. You know, I don't want to be a stevedore. And I also don't want I've often told people this too. Don't let your house become a museum to mourning. So many people fill their homes with relics of sadness. Things that they have to keep because they belong to dead people that they loved. And when they look at that thing, all they feel is grief. You are not a museum. Your life is not a museum. Your life is a vital, living, energetic, explosive, amazing miracle. You're not here to be a curator. You're here to be alive yourself. So some of that stuff has to go. It doesn't mean you didn't love the person. Keep one thing that makes you actually feel joyful, but the rest of it. My friend Rhea finally got rid of a table she's been carrying around. It was her mother's. It was a broken table that didn't suit or match or fit anywhere in her home, but she kept it forever until the day she realized, this isn't my mother.
Yeah, she probably realized, why have I kept it so long?
This broken object is not my mother. It's just a broken table. And she put it on the street. She kissed it and put it on the street with the sign that said free, which is, you know, the double meaning. The table was free and so was she. So that stuff has to go sometimes. It's not a violation or an abandonment of the person. It's a reaffirmation of your own vitality and the fact that you're still alive. You're still here.
Still here. Liz, such a delight to speak to you. Really, really, really. And good luck with the rest of the tour and get back to work.
Get back to work.
Right. Get back to work.
Drinking wine and eating Hershey's Kisses.
Well, yes, get back to work. Drink wine. The Baudelaire line, enivrez-vous de vin, de poésie et de vertu. Inebriate yourself of wine, virtue and poetry and just have a magnificent time while you're doing all of that. And thank you for taking this call.
You're welcome, Paul. Can we do one last thing? Yeah. I'm going to send you I'm going to send you a poem I wrote.
Oh, and wonderful.
If you write one, send it to me.
I will do that. I will do that. I will try.
I haven't shared these with anybody, so permission is granted. I will send you one, and if you feel welcome, send me one.
I'll try my hand at it, for sure.
Okay.
A huge hug to you, and thank you so much.
My pleasure, Paul. I always love talking to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.